This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. Plankton's dying.
You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them.
The change that we're seeing at the moment is taking place extremely rapidly, and it's the speed of change. We're seeing levels of pH in the oceans now that probably haven't been experienced for 55 million years. So we're going back a long time. The time of the dinosaurs, put it that way. I find it very difficult to tell people what a scary situation we're in at the moment. The oceans are changing in a huge way, and I'm particularly worried for my grandchildren. The changes we thought were happening in the future, but we're actually seeing them happening now. They will affect all our lives, the whole of the world. In the next few decades to 50 years, we will see great changes taking place in our world.
That was Professor Chris Reed of the Marine Institute from the University of Plymouth in Britain. He's talking about a report that must be the greatest headline of our times. A new report from the International Program on the State of the Ocean, or IPSO, features 27 top experts on the oceans. They warn, all of them warn, the oceans are in a state of dying from multiple causes, all of them human. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm sorry to interrupt the latest murder story on TV, the Hollywood gossip, or even the fires, the storms, floods and drought, or what have you, with news from very serious science. Climate change is not coming. It is here. Carbon is not only flooding the atmosphere, but the deep sea. The oceans, stripped of the big species we eat, poisoned by our waste into expanding dead zones, with coral richness turning into white deserts. The oceans are changing chemically from all our carbon. They are becoming more acid. It is news that could lead to mass extinction. And thank you for having the courage to listen, to face the awful truth. Later in this Radio EcoShock show, you will learn how governments sold you out on reactor safety. The Japanese people learned to their lasting sorrow. Government turned nuclear safety over to the industry, with devastating results at Fukushima and well beyond. You will hear three sources confirm the same regulatory system in the United States was gutted in 1999 by politicians. There has been virtually no enforcement ever since, with dangerous reactor problems left unfixed. On our present course, an American Fukushima is just a matter of time. Oh, and by the way, the law prohibits you or your local or state government even bringing up anything about safety of these old dilapidated reactors. You have no say. Our experts from within the nuclear industry and a former member of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will explain how democracy does not apply. But surely, the science of extinction must come first. Here is another short clip from Dr. Alex Rogers, scientific director of IPSO and professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford. He is talking about the new report.
I think if we continue on the current trajectory, we are looking at a mass extinction of marine species. Even if only coral reef ecosystems go down, which it looks like they will, certainly by the end of the century, that would, in my mind, constitute a mass extinction event. And that's simply because of the huge diversity associated with those systems in terms of the actual reef-building corals themselves, and also the myriad of organisms. There are some scientific estimates, there are something like up to 9 million species associated with coral reefs. However, many of the symptoms, if you like, that we're seeing of change in the oceans indicate that the effects will be much wider than just coral reef ecosystems. Rising temperatures are already changing distribution of organisms. Animals are moving further north or south as basically to track the temperatures that they like to live in. And of course, the animals living in the tropics and at the polar extremes of the oceans, they don't have anywhere to go. So there's a good chance we'll see high levels of extinction, both in low latitudes and in high latitudes, simply as a result of temperature change. Ocean acidification, which is one of the sort of three things we know has been associated with mass extinctions in the past, we're only just getting to grips with the effects of ocean acidification on marine organisms. The more we learn, the more concerned we become. We're discovering that not only does acidification of the oceans affect animals that secrete calcium carbonate to build shells, but it also affects the ability of organisms to perceive their environment. It actually changes their chemical perception through smell of the environment. It affects development and all sorts of other aspects of physiology of marine organisms. It's really caught the scientific community by surprise, and we still do not understand the full implications of it.
Extinction. You want to talk extinction? Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington makes a career studying the five previous mass deaths on planet Earth. He's advised on extinction specials for Animal Planet and a recent climate special on National Geographic TV. His book, Under a Green Sky, set the scientific world on edge as Ward proposed a way a change in ocean life could extinguish almost everything that breathes on land. Judging by the geological record, life, Ward said in a later book, that was the Medea hypothesis, life tends towards mass suicide. Oh, how jolly. You would think Ward would be the most depressing conversationalist in the world. Quite the opposite. I always enjoy talking with him, and we're going to do that right now.
Radio EcoShock.
Peter Ward, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
What is your take on the rash of wild weather in the spring of 2011? You know, the floods, the fires, the storms?
Well, it's pretty simple. 10 years ago, we started seeing these really bad made-for-TV disaster movies about the wild weather that's coming when global warming hits. Well, the wild weather is here because global warming has hit. And now everybody's acting as if we had no idea this was going to happen. How could this possibly happen? Where did those tornadoes come from? You put more water in the atmosphere, you heat up that water, and you get wilder weather. It's pretty simple.
Okay, well now, NASA's James Hansen says we should be thinking about many tipping points in the climate, not just one, but there's one that I'm particularly interested in, and that is, at what point do nature's feedback loops, like, you know, the melting in the Arctic sea ice, and when do they become more powerful than human inputs from fossil fuel burning? So my first question is, do we have the scientific capability to know if we're at such a tipping point?
Well, there's so many of the tipping points, and I think your listeners probably know that these are really sort of like waterfalls that you go over, you can't go back up, but they're caused by natural systems that move along at a certain state and then increase in either frequency or duration, just like we have all these new storms. The tipping point that scares me the most deals with Canada, and it deals especially with the Arctic sea ice. That's the one that's the scariest, because as we lose that sea ice, most people think, aha, the ice is melting up there, sea level must be going up, but that's not the case. But what happens is that all that white ice, which reflects so wonderfully sunlight back into space, causes the planet to warm up. When you have a dark ocean, it absorbs heat. When you have ice, it reflects the sunshine back into space. When we lose all that ice, we get warmer and warmer oceans, even way up there in the north. That's a feedback, because as you think about it, as the planet gets warmer, it melts that ice at an ever more northerly latitude. You start getting progressively warmer, which makes it warmer. This is called a positive feedback loop. And it's this sort of thing that I think, when you speak about tipping points, scares me the most. I mean, this is a positive feedback loop which could have the most significance of all for the heating of the planet.
And another one we just learned about from another guest who talked about the tundra and the fact that we could get giant peat fires there. He talked about the Indonesian peat fires that raised the levels in 97 and 98, and he says that could happen again in the Arctic as it gets exposed and melted and ready to burn.
Well, the other aspect about the tundra, too, is that you've got a lot of frozen methane, and methane is a fantastic greenhouse gas, and these are called clathrates. These, too, once it warms, start melting at ever more northerly latitudes, and once again, methane is a fantastic greenhouse gas. It's four times as powerful as carbon dioxide. The nice thing about methane is it breaks down in only 15 years, but the bad thing is it breaks down into carbon dioxide, so you can't win.
And again, in New Zealand, Dr. Hansen spoke about more evidence for sudden and abrupt climate change, and I haven't heard that a lot from him before. What do you know about that? How fast could things change?
The scariest possible thing that could happen to us, I think, societally, is if we had a collapse of the Western Antarctic ice sheet. The interesting aspect of the last 6 months is researchers have found that, indeed, this did happen. A collapse is a case where, because much of it is already below sea level, it has caused the crust of the Earth to be compressed downward from its very weight. It could break loose and huge, Canadian province-sized chunks of ice go flowing out into the ocean. And with that, that rapidly melts. And that's where you could get a 10-foot, or say a 3 to 5 meter sea level rise in 5 to 10 years. And we've just found evidence that this such a thing did happen about 1 million years ago. And it was provoked by a short-term warming, a warming that was nowhere near as bad as we have now. So this is the single greatest calamity that could happen to us fast enough. In fact, I had a Hollywood company say they wanted to do a movie about this. And they said, could we have a 10-foot rise overnight? I said, well, not even nature's that bad, but I think 10 feet even in 10 years would be as disastrous as you'd ever want.
Well, talking about the extremes, I've never forgotten a passage from your book, Under a Green Sky, where you talked about a 10-million-year-long record of rock that was almost without life. You've also helped a series about animal extinction for the TV show Animal Planet. Are we looking at the possibility of a mass extinction event here on Earth if things go out of control?
We are, but that's way down the road. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of years probably to produce any sort of extinction that would be as catastrophic as really the big ones in the past. But you don't really need anything as horribly catastrophic as some of those ancient catastrophes to really still make things really, really uncomfortable. Just for our own sense of well-being, we just have to have pollinators disappear. And look what has happened in the last few years when we had all the honeybee problems, and there were a number of different diseases and parasites. But I had I have an orchard, and my orchard 2 years ago just quit producing fruit. And last year we had no fruit at all because there wasn't a single honeybee to be found where I live in Seattle, Washington. Look, if an extinction is selective enough to take out, there are just some key species that are so much more important to making ecosystems work than others. The mass extinction takes out everything, but a selective extinction of the stuff you really need. Another one would be denitrifying bacteria, the bacteria that attach to roots and make the nitrogen that plants need to live. You kill off some of these microbes, and we're in big trouble.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with author and professor of biology, earth, and space sciences at the University of Washington, Dr. Peter Ward. In your later book, The Medea Hypothesis, you questioned whether natural systems have a built-in balancing mechanism or any life insurance. Is this really a giant ongoing experiment without any breaks?
Well, you're talking about the human experiment I think we're doing with our atmosphere. This is the greatest single natural history experiment ever made in the history of the planet, as far as I can see. Experiment in the sense that we are throwing up gases at a rate faster than has ever happened in the past. Even during the great extinctions, those lasted for thousands of years, putting carbon dioxide up as fast as we humans are doing it. We've only been doing it for a couple of centuries. But should we continue to burn coal and oil at the rate that we do? And we certainly will run out of oil in a few centuries at the rate we're using it. But we're not going to run out of coal for 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years at this rate. And that is the experiment that scares me the most.
I find it unsettling to think, you know, that there is no balancing mechanism. James Lovelock thinks there is something will react to limit the warming, but other scientists have said no. No, it could go all the way. I mean, James Hansen even said we could lose the atmosphere. That seems pretty extreme to me. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think we can lose the atmosphere. But Jim Hansen has provided an enormous service to my country, the United States, and to the world in drawing attention to the fact that so many of the estimates that have come out have been underestimates. And Hansen has also brought to the fore the idea that scientists themselves can be terribly intimidated when they find discoveries, when they find numbers that really seem to indicate the catastrophe coming. Scientists are a very cautious lot, and he has come out. On the other hand, some of his ideas, some of the thoughts, I think, are over the top. I don't think his estimate of sea level rise of as much as 10 feet by 2100, that's not going to be borne out, I think, unless we really do have some enormous breakdown in Antarctica. But you don't really need to oversell this stuff. I mean, even the conservative estimates are as scary as anything we should ever have to deal with.
I agree with you. Now, Peter Ward, here's a problem that I'm having right now as a kind of amateur journalist, let's say. I expected to cover climate stories as they came up, but I'm just not prepared for the multiple disasters that come at the same time in many regions of the world. We can't even cover it. So is this destabilization just a temporary phase, do you think, or is it the new reality?
Well, I'm hoping it's just a temporary phase. I mean, after all, we have had this switch off between the El Nino and La Nina currents back and forth, and we just turned one of them off. That changeover in state has affected where I live in the northwest part of North America, and we can have these warm, dry winters or these exceedingly wet ones. We've just had the heaviest snowpack in the history of the Cascade Mountains, the history of anybody's records, the heaviest snowpack ever. And the answer, the reason for that is simple. There's just so much more moisture in the atmosphere. You know, people say after last year's heavy snows in the east coast of the U.S., they say, look, there's no global warming. It's snowing. Well, come on. All you need to do is just get more and more moisture. You're still going to have cold, even in a globally warm world. We get one of these Arctic highs that come down and hit moisture-laden clouds over New York City, and of course you get 2 feet of snow. Well, we've really been nailed in the Northwest because of these snows this year. And so people are rejoicing. This year we have plenty for the snowpack. But these things, as high as it is snowpack, it can revert to as extremely low as we've ever seen within a 2 or 3 year cycle. And it's this switching back and forth that nature finds very disturbing.
Yeah, that high snowpack, I think, has resulted in the Missouri River flood that has endangered a nuclear plant in the United States, but that's another story. Well, look, back in the human scheme of things, climate negotiations are so deadlocked, it seems, that nobody wants to hear about it. I can feel listeners just clicking off when we start talking about climate negotiations. Should we pay attention to those international talks?
Yeah, we should, and we need to pay attention to what our politicians say about it, but we need to pay more attention to our politicians when they don't say anything about it. There has to be someone who takes account of what the politicians do and don't do. And the fact that they stay away from it or won't talk about it, that's not satisfactory. I mean, I'm terribly disappointed in Obama. He's backed away from any sort of backbone for the climate work at all. Oh, I know his opponent, President Obama takes this tack. Well, as bad as I am, my Republican opponent, if he's elected, would be way worse, so you better support me. That's not good enough anymore. I think you have to stand up in that famous movie Network, I'm mad as hell, and I'm just not going to take it anymore. We all collectively have to get our voices and begin yelling at that window.
And after that last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2007, as you know, there was a vicious pushback against climate science and scientists. And that's still happening, most recently in Australia, where climate scientists got some death threats. Now, some governments, and they said IPCC scientists should just report the facts, don't advocate anything. The IPCC was going to be reworked, they said, to remove any advocacy. What have you heard about the upcoming work for the 2012 report?
Scientists are scared. And we are people, and we are people with our own fallibilities, but it was the smear that happened in the so-called climate gate that affected a lot of people in a highly negative way. I mean, you really, there has been this very draconian sort of thuggish point of view from the right-wing side of American politics that climate scientists are not to be believed. There will be no substantive discussion of climate change in the upcoming American election. It's just not going to happen. Both sides will stay away from it, and this has me extremely worried, extremely worried.
Well, every year we're just adding another record amount of carbon.
Yeah, well, there's we're already seeing the accounting. I'm just, my heart went out to those victims of the tornadoes. I mean, it broke my heart because I think a lot of that was avoidable had we taken even a slighter change to climate policy several decades ago. who knows? I mean, these things are such knife edge. But the tornadoes that happen, it's not just an accident that happened. It's just not a whim of nature. It is because the climate is warmer. There's more water in the atmosphere. And these great turning cells caused by heat hitting this very roiled up atmosphere creates these devastating storms. People are dying because of political inaction. And it's just beginning.
But Peter, Arizona just had the largest forest fire in its history. Texas was burning. The drought across the Southwest is just fantastic. And there's a drought in southern Florida, where a lot of our food comes from. But these very same people are electing Tea Party candidates who must deny global warming in order to get elected. It breaks my brain to think about this.
Well, I mean, Alex, good thing you're on the radio trying to rouse up people to at least think about it. Look, we have a woman who, Sarah Palin, who just told us that, in fact, Paul Revere, the famous patriot, was riding through Boston telling the British to watch out, the Americans are coming. So it doesn't surprise me that she's not going to stand up to say, the global warming is coming, the global warming is coming. That's not quite her suite of things, I think.
Well, just to tune us in, you have been working on what the previous worlds have looked like. Could you give us a description of a previous hothouse world?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Actually, I've spent the last 3 years in Antarctica looking at the southernmost extreme of a hothouse world. We know much about the Cretaceous. This is the time period, 125 to about 65 million years ago, the last of the age of dinosaurs. And so we were looking at rocks of that age in Antarctica, trying to see the fossils and the nature of it. And even in Antarctica, the plants we're pulling out of rocks about 70 million years in age are tropical. We've got ferns, we've got these beautiful broadleaf, beautiful flowering plants, even preserved in rock. You have a world that is absolutely warm and a world where sea level is 150 meters higher than it is now. So you've got an ocean world. The world is so oceanic that, in fact, the central part of the United States and all of the central provinces of Canada are underwater. I mean, you find all those beautiful marine fossils going all the way through the central provinces of Canada of Cretaceous age. The great North American seaway split the continent in half. That's what we have to look forward to if we continue warming the world, because there has never been a case where you have a world with 1,000 parts per million carbon dioxide. That's only three times what we have now. There's never been a world, from all our studies, that had any ice on it at 1,000 ppm. We get to 1,000, we keep it there, we're losing that ice, and there's all your Antarctica sitting in your living room.
I was surprised to learn that so much of Antarctica is actually deeply underwater once those glaciers melt. I mean, people thought the glaciers would just sort of keep going back and then they'd rise up on land and the warmer water wouldn't affect them anymore. But in fact, there's gigantic valleys that are totally, will be under the sea.
That is absolutely correct. The ice is heavy, and rock seems like the strongest stuff on the planet, but it's not. Enormous swaths of ice sitting on a continent push the continent down. We're seeing the same thing after the last ice age of 17,000 years ago. We're still seeing the land rebound back from that, and it's springing back up, but it doesn't spring back fast enough. In the case of Antarctica, you're going to have an enormous inland ocean there, and you're also going to lose a great central ocean part of Greenland. You know, people say, wow, this would be great. We melt the ice. We've got a new continent to deal with. Well, most of that continent will be underwater, as will Greenland.
And can I ask you, as we start to wrap up here, what you're working on now and whether you have perhaps a new book in the works?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to stay political to the point that I can. I finished a book about sea level rise, our flooded world, and in fact, it was just on National Geographic Television, the special of it, two nights ago. But I'm so discouraged about the level of science literacy in my country, America, that the books that I write don't seem to do so well. So I wrote a novel. I tried to write a novel that's very similar to that of Contact, the great Carl Sagan novel, where I'm trying to get scientific principles in there, gussied up as a novel, but it is about ancient climate change and deals with the fossil record, and I'm just trying to get the story out about past mass extinctions or greenhouse worlds in a different form. So whether or not it ever gets published, I don't know, but that's been the latest effort.
Now, we just have to drop some humans into this ancient world, and there we've got a movie script starting to go.
There you go.
Well, you've been listening to Dr. Peter Ward. He's an expert in the climates of the deep past. He's an author and professor at the University of Washington. His latest book that I know of is The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Peter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Alex, thank you so much for caring so much.
We'll be right back with the inside track on America's Fukushima. From Amherst, Massachusetts, this Ethan Miller song is sung by Ben Groskop and Dan Inglis. Come Winter, first broadcast now on Radio EcoShock, Red Valley Fog at myspace.com.
I remember 6 feet under, the ground is frozen beneath the snow. And I remember longing for summer, huddled round the fire as the cold winds blow. Are breaking in January, and the ice is melting if it ever froze at all. The world is turning, the sun is burning, we are the children of the thaw. Are you prepared? 'Cause all I know is that I'm scared. Stay beside me, hold me tightly. You don't have to tell me that everything's okay. Just help me to believe, as my hope starts to leave, that there's something we can do besides pray. And I cry to the trees, don't wake up, stay asleep. This is all just a dream. I'll see you in the spring, if it comes like before, or with violence like war. If the rains drench the ground, if the birds make a sound, what was springtime? Was winter? What came after the fall? Anything at all? Remember, 6 feet under, the ground was frozen beneath the snow. And I remember longing for summer, huddled round the fire as the cold winds blow. But the buds are breaking in January. Ice is melting if it ever froze at all. The world is turning, the sun is burning, we are the children of the world.